our leaders in sports would do well to be cognizant of their greater calling here than just to get games going. I mean, I know there's going to be a temptation like, oh, we need diversion. Oh, once you just get games going, that's great. Well, the context of the times has been totally reframed by what we're experiencing right now. We have no reason to even necessarily be able to dig in and understand that we're going to be able to start playing. I mean, things might start happening, but things might shut down again. There's so many factors at play. I guess I just hope that that baseball sees that as part of its purpose, understands that as part of its purpose.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and that is the voice of Vahe Gregorian, longtime St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports writer, now an award-winning sports columnist for the Kansas City Star, and, full disclosure, a groomsman in my wedding. I'm a big fan. This past week, Kansas City Royals general manager Dayton Moore explained his team's no cuts, continued pay, plans for the minor leaguers. He did so with an eloquent description of the role minor leaguers, who we never know, names we never hear, the ones who don't even come close to the majors, and yet how they are a vital part of baseball's place in a community as coaches, scouts, umps, and the nurturers of future players and fans. I call them the Johnny Appleseeds of baseball. And there's cause for concern there will be fewer than ever in 2021 and beyond. Vahe was on the call with Dayton Moore, so I wanted to talk to him about the tone of the conversation, the Royals' policy, and of course, the Royals' plans for the 2020 season should it get off the ground, and the role the Royals' new manager, Mike Matheny, will play in that. Our conversation kept revisiting the notion of community and baseball's importance in making a connection. Let me first tell you about our sponsor. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. That's Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. And now here's my conversation from opposite ends of I-70 in Missouri with Kansas City Star sports columnist Vahe Gregorian. Vahe, it's great to have you on here. Let's start by just telling me about what this conference call was like with Kansas City Royals general manager Dayton Moore. What was the purpose? You know, what was kind of the tone of it? What did you take away from it?
Well, Derek, first of all, great to be with you. You know, what we've been having happen here, and I think this is maybe a little bit the case in St. Louis. You know, we've kind of gotten semi-regular updates with Royals general manager Dayton Moore. We've done a few Zoom teleconferences with him. He's also quite accessible for the media in other instances too, but Dayton wants to kind of keep his finger on the pulse and keep us apprised of the pulse. And I think also feels it's in his job, not job description, but in his way of seeing the job that connecting to the media is connecting to Kansas City, is connecting to baseball. And so he makes himself available that way. This sort of a little lighter note, it appeared to me that he was in his office for this one. Previously, he had done one from his home and had in the background a rather graphic rendition of David slaying Goliath. His wife, Marianne, doesn't like him having as the background photo. So, not photo, but portrait. So he shook it up a little bit.
Was that a gift for beating the Mets in the World Series?
I don't know if it was that, but you know, Dayton being Dayton, he was asked to elaborate on why on the meaning of that, having that in the background, and spoke to it rather well. And I think I naturally, as a small market town and knowing what he inherited when he came here, all those sorts of things, I think it's easy for Dayton to see himself, see the Royals as sort of emblematic of that, and or that as emblematic of them. So I think in that sense, at least, he takes it to heart and uses that as a little bit of a point of motivation, maybe not every day specifically, but certainly in some way or another.
That conference call was on the eve of the decision that teams had to make, because an agreement in March that all the teams came to was that they would provide a $400 weekly stipend to the minor leaguers, active minor leaguers in their organizations. That expired by agreement on May 31st. And so we saw this rollout of plans, this rollout of policies by teams, some of which, like the Oakland Athletics, stopped the payment altogether. Others, like the Washington Nationals, said they were going to reduce it. That they later changed that when major leaguers decided to cover the gap, and then the ownership stepped up and said, no, we'll continue to pay. Cardinals have continued to pay through the end of June. Other teams have extended that through August. Some have said they're just going to pay it for the entire schedule as planned for the minor leaguers. What was the tone of Dayton's kind of description of what the Royals were going to do? And can you take us through what the Royals are doing that is maybe different than any other team besides, say, the Minnesota Twins?
Well, I think it is those two teams exclusively that are just basically not blinking an eye in the middle of this, and will continue to provide for that aspect of the organization in a way that says it matters as much as anything else they do. Going back just to a second to the tone, it was interesting because Dayton just sort of started, he was asked about it and just sort of started talking about it. There'd been word that was what they were going to do, but he ended up delivering words that were pretty eloquent about not just why they need to do this now, but the broader impact of this on the game, on what the game wants to stand for, on what the Royals want to stand for. But I want to be careful to say he was not grandstanding in this in any sense, and specifically not grandstanding and saying, like, you know, this is what we're doing, nobody else is doing this. That's not him. He, in fact, was careful to say, we don't know everybody else's situation. We don't know all the other things involved with decision-making process, but this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it. The other aspect of it, Derek, that's a little, maybe it's not obscured and everything else, but it's a little interesting and I think bears emphasis, is that they're doing this with a new owner who has yet to have a regular season game played under his stewardship, John Sherman. So Dayton is very careful to make the point that this is John Sherman's money, and the 16 or 17 is other owners. So we're at a time now where we're waiting to see what new ownership of the Royals will stand for. And this is a pretty nice first statement without a game even being played.
Yeah, they haven't made a dollar, right? Is that fair to say that, well, I mean, it's not entirely true, but they haven't made their first revenue off a ticket sale, this ownership group?
Well, I guess, you know, I wish I knew how to describe that situation, right? I don't know how this, like, for instance, tickets purchased, refunded, et cetera, what that means in this, right? You know what? I don't know how any of that's working, and I'm a little embarrassed that I don't. Maybe you do know, but certainly you wouldn't know specific to the Royals. But I just don't know exactly how that's working. But I think you can say comfortably they haven't even played a game. They don't have whatever revenue stream they would be expecting coming, and they're making this gesture because it's for the good of the franchise, good of the game, good of the city. Even I think the city takes pride, even if we're talking about an approach to minor leaguers, the city takes pride in that. And you know, one of the other interesting things with this, I don't imagine Dayton knew that this would be kind of celebrated throughout baseball, but it did take on kind of a viral life of its own. The words were sent out by a number of people on social media, including a lot of former Royals, Peter Moylan and Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas. And I just think it was a nice sort of little oasis in all this, not just the words, obviously, but the deed.
Let me read the words as transcribed by Alec Lewis, a former Mizzou student, Mizzou grad, I guess I should say, who writes for The Athletic there in Kansas City. He put it out on Twitter, and so I'm going to read from his transcription. Just this is what Dayton Moore said on this conference call with Kansas City reporters. Understand this. The minor league players, the players you'll never know about, the players that never get out of rookie ball or high A, those players have as much impact on the growth of our game than 10-year or 15-year veteran players. They have as much opportunity to influence the growth of our game as those individuals who played for a long time, because those individuals go back into their communities and teach the game, work in academies, are JUCO coaches, college coaches, scouts, coaches in pro baseball. They're growing the game constantly because they're so passionate about it. So we felt it was really, really important not to release one minor league player during this time, a time we needed to stand behind them. I think that's such a powerful story of or explanation of the trickle-down effect of baseball, and also baseball's kind of history as a grassroots game. You think back to, as far as Cardinal history goes, think back to kind of the widespread farm system that Branch Rickey created and the value that has for an organization that became a regional team because of that and because of the reach of KMOX. I mean, those are symbiotic. And now you have a whole area. Like, my granddad grew up in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and, you know, he could get KMOX and became a Cardinal fan. Jerry Walker, a longtime executive in baseball and former general manager, grew up in Oklahoma. And because of Stan Musial and photos of Stan Musial in their newspaper, they could mimic Stan Musial's batting stance. The reason why there was photos of Stan Musial's in the local paper in Oklahoma was because of the widespread farm system the Cardinals had, that boys from Oklahoma could see minor league games. You know, kids could root for their players who then made their way up to the Cardinals. I mean, I think that what Dayton struck on is something that really worries me about the downsizing of minor league baseball, is that we are reducing access to baseball, reducing access to the role baseball has in communities. And thus those communities will look elsewhere than baseball for entertainment and for connections to the past.
Well, you're sure right about that. And there's much as you described, sort of the symbiotic effect in the gathering momentum positive way. I suppose a symbiotic effect, that's probably the wrong word when it's trending the other direction, because it's a drain of energy. It's a drain of exposure. But when you're already seeing, you know, diminishing numbers in the inner cities and other things that are gaining, I think you could make a debate that baseball remains America's game, but I think you would probably be facing more evidence that it's the NFL, you know, things like that. And now you're talking about contracting or reducing or diminishing the broader aspects, sprawling aspects of the game, as Dayton actually so well lays out. And, you know, I think we're not getting that much into this on this podcast, but when you have kind of the bad mojo between the MLB and the Players Association on getting this done amid a pandemic, the pandemic's implications itself, all these things, it's not a great time for baseball that way. And it makes me sad. I don't know what the answers are, which is sort of one of the dangers of going in this direction. But I think clinging to is the wrong term. That makes it sound like you're desperately holding on to something. But I think reinforcing the sense of value of the broader operation, that's a good thing to hear right now. And really expressed it in pretty vivid ways. In fact, I don't know that there's anything overwhelmingly novel necessarily about what he said. It's all logical, but there's kind of an eloquence of simplicity in how he laid it out. Right.
Yeah.
And I think you can read those, whatever it is, 120 words and really be reminded of what each cog in the system means. And for you, it immediately spurred thoughts of the 58 farm teams the Cardinals had under Branch.
Yeah.
you know, all those sorts of things. And it's useful, I think, to take those words and those thoughts and step back and think about how things become enmeshed in our society and also what you can do to try to sustain them.
I just listened to it and kind of in my mind's eye, and also one of, as I've heard just about how they want to reduce the size of the minor leagues and have teams, you know, that have been part of system, some of the smaller teams in the smaller towns leave. And that the argument is, well, you know, the facilities aren't good enough. And so we need to leave the facility behind as opposed to we need to enhance the facility. It struck me as this notion that like, look, we're bringing the Johnny Appleseeds off the road, you know, the ones that would scatter seeds for future fans and for future players. And that I think it was short-sighted because it was really focused on like, well, how many of these players are actually going to make the major leagues, right? What's the percentage of that? That's right. The wrong question.
Right.
How many of these players right. are going to inspire the next player who maybe doesn't make the major leagues, but becomes a fan and buys season tickets? This notion of like, tell me the percentage of high A players or low A players or short season, but tell me the percentage of Johnson City players who actually make the majors is missing the point of how that provides nourishment. I mean, that's where the seeds sprout for fans and future players. There is a kid who has gone to a Johnson City game, been exposed to baseball, said, I want to play that and become a major leaguer. You know, that happens. We know that happens. So isn't that worth the investment for the team? Because what's the drawback? Well, I think we're about to find the drawback, Vahe, in the sense that from a PR standpoint, if next year these places start shuttering after a convulsive 2020, just a terrible 2020 in all extenses, baseball's going to take the PR hit for being viewed as abandoning a community, not leaving a community, abandoning it.
You're right. That's well said, as is. I love your Johnny Appleseed point, and it's, you know, it's very vivid when you think of it that way. And it's very easy to see. It's so easy to see the damage done that it's hard to really understand the upside to this. I mean, I'm not going to try to make that case because I just don't understand it really well enough, I don't think. But there is no upside. And so you're abandoning communities, to use your words, which are spot on. And you're just reducing the scope of the game in a way that I think will be damaging. You know, the other thing is kind of funny. It I know. Okay, so maybe facilities is a fair part of the case, right?
Absolutely. Case
to do this. So there is, in fact, it might actually be fun to do this, to get with some current major league players and talk about how the facilities. The rickety facilities and the horrendous bus rides were such a part of why they treasure where they are now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've talked to guys about this multiple times over the years, the journey, the path, and there's something about the process by which you make it in baseball that's kind of precious in all this too. And look, we're at a time in our country where you don't just say, well, we've always done it this way. We should keep doing it this way, right? That has a lot bigger implications than just this. But you need to try to assess what's lost, what's damaged, what's important here. And I do believe in baseball, the journey is part of the aspect of all this that's treasured when you finally make it. And part of that journey is that it's rigorous in certain ways. Not that it couldn't be made smoother and still be important, but to cut it off at its legs, that's what it feels like. I just don't get it.
One 19 years ago, actually probably about 19 years ago, later this month, one of the assignments I got from the Rocky Mountain News, I was at the Rocky Mountain News at the time, and they said, hey, professional baseball is returning to Wyoming. The Casper Rockies were going to play their first game. It was a short season rookie ball club. You know, go up there, go to the orientation. This is when the players are all arriving. Just write a story about the ceremony of professional baseball returning to the state of Wyoming for the first time in more than 80 years. So I did. I drove up there. And while I was there at the orientation, the manager of the team, who had long been, you know, just a treasured presence with the Rockies, you know, their early version of, say, a George Kissel, a guy who taught fundamentals, a guy who was always present. He had major league experience, all this stuff, PJ Carey. You know, he says, hey, why don't you come with us? Their ballpark, Mike Lansing Field, wasn't going to open until the second week of the season, the third the third or fourth series. I can't remember off the top of my head. So they had a long bus trip to start their season because their field wasn't done. And he said, why don't you come on the bus with us? And so I called my wife and I called my boss and said, hey, can I go with them here? It's about 10, 11 days on the bus. And my editor was like, that would be incredible. That would be an incredible story. Come back with that. And my wife was all right with it. She was very patient. It was just the two of us at the time. We didn't have a kid. So maybe that was part of the calculus. So I got to ride the bus with these rookie level players. And to see their stories unfold, you know, the kids from the Dominican who had known only, you know, Dominican academies, and some of them asking where the skyscrapers were because that was the America that they saw in photos and on TV. And we're going by the Grand Tetons. And it's like, well, that's the equivalent of the skyscrapers in this part of the country. And then the catcher who I think was there, was back at that level, had been promoted, was back at that level maybe for a third summer. And as we talked, you know, just the recognition he had that they weren't developing him as a catcher anymore. And he started to understand they were developing him as a coach, and how, what that meant to him to have the team have faith in him as an instructor and want him to get the game experience that improved that, but that it meant not viewing himself as a guy who could play the game. That was a really profound conversation with him as he came to kind of understand that. And I've forever treasure that assignment because of what it showed me. I hope that I rose to the level when I wrote that story, but it, you know, I mean, those kids, some of them were billeted in families. You take those teams out of those cities, then there's no reason for those families to have a connection to baseball. There's no, you know, infrastructure that invites a community that is centered around a ballpark. And golly, that makes me sad, to be honest.
Yeah, it makes me sad too. And when you took that trip, you know, this is a different aspect of all this, but it is something I'm concerned about in the current climate and going forward. Part of the beauty of that trip was you ultimately were able to take readers where they don't get to go to appreciate this. And I realize I'm going on a tangent here, but
we're fine. That's what this podcast is about, Vahe.
I'm concerned going forward about access points and relationships and, you know, the difference between being on, you know, face to face with somebody and talking to them and cultivating relationships, and you know what you can do and achieve by phone or on Zoom, and you know, that maybe that's a whole nother topic for another time. But that's the first thing I thought of when you were describing that trip.
Yeah.
And you know, we're both probably romantic, kind of nostalgic guys too, but I think we're both rooted in practicality here, and I hope we don't lose what has been so important, and opportunity is a big part of that. I have not, and please chastise me or update me if I'm wrong, I have not heard any specific movements to reduce emphasis at academies, but I do worry what if that starts to happen with Latin American academies and things of that nature. I don't think that's really in the cards right now, but when we think about phases of development and opportunity, and you know, whether it's one out of 1,127 guys that make it to the major leagues, I think of the academies and what that time at academies has meant to people who,
yeah, great point,
who have hope and a chance, and I'm sure a love of the game and a love of the organizations. That give them a chance, you know, by and large anyway. So anyway, I'm far afield, but that's
a great point. Yeah, that was, I mean, we, this is about a month ago, month and a half ago on one of the podcasts, we were talking about the things that we miss going on, you know, about sports right now. And then, you know, the way I kind of asked it is, that's fine that you miss it now. What are you worried that won't return? And the thing that worries me that won't return is the late bloomers. like baseball's late bloomers, the 27-year-old, 28-year-old guy who figures out his swing or learns a new pitch or finally has a healthy season, that with reduced rosters in the minors, reduced number of places to play in the minors, there'll be reduced reason to keep a guy around that long. We saw that with some of the releases that the Cardinals made, just as an example. You know, they had 33 releases on one day, and one of the guys released was a guy they drafted pretty high as an outfielder, stuck around as an outfielder for three seasons, but recently reinvented himself as a power left-hander. So, and then before he could go into a full season and see how that went, he's released. Now, he'll get a chance with another team. Maybe he won't, because they don't know him like the Cardinals do. But a late bloomer like that with reduced opportunity isn't going to get the time to find himself and then contribute. And maybe, you know, maybe he would have contributed for half a season. Maybe he would have contributed for two seasons. Maybe he would have been a September call-up who changes the look of a bullpen for the postseason. We don't know. But we do know that, like, by pruning the branches, there won't be any late bloomers.
Yeah. And look, I think there's something, it's funny about pruning. I think, I think you get growth through pruning to some degree, but that's different than, just getting rid of all the limbs. How about that?
Right. Okay. Yeah. There we go. That's axing off the limbs. That's what we're doing.
Right arms and left arms. So
that's right. Yeah.
So yeah, it's. Hey, I want to say something else too. That
sure.
It goes back to something we were talking about earlier, but I wanted to make this point about Dayton Moore and about a couple things I've had the opportunity to see through his eyes. And
please do.
One of them goes back to the experience that you and Chris Lee went through in the Dominican Republic for Oscar Tavares's funeral. What a horrible time. What an awful, awful thing. But part of what your experience was having some trouble with stuff getting taken out of your car, or as I recall anyway.
And we had all of our stuff stolen. Yeah.
So part of that, when Yordano Ventura died, I think I both understood that we needed to try to get to the Dominican right away because of what you and Chris went through, but also that I wasn't sure how we would manage the logistics after what you guys had been through. And so, long story short, I'm condensing for time purposes, but we were in touch with Dayton that afternoon, the afternoon of Yordano Ventura's death. Sam Mellinger was in his hotel room with him in Atlanta. Long story how that happened. And we worked out that, of course, the Royals would like us to be with them in the Dominican and embed with them to cover this, which was extraordinary.
Yeah,
I don't know many organizations that would do that. In fact, I seems to me very few. So I was on the plane there the next day with John Sleaser, our great photographer. How lucky have we both been, Derek, to work with wonderful photographers?
Oh, it's essential.
It is. And so we got in a bus with the Royals, 8-10 players and front office people the next morning, and documented the whole day. And we were able to take people to a place where they literally couldn't go on a really important day in Kansas City. And at the end of the day, I remember, you know, seeking out Dayton to just say, you know, thank him for letting us do that and trying to express my gratitude and explain that we don't think many people would do this. And he just said it was important for Kansas City to have this day documented. And it words to that effect. Anyway, when we talked about doing this podcast, I thought to myself that I want to make sure I told that story because I think it speaks to and lends more depth to what's going on here now. And I'm also at a point in my life where I want to, hopefully I've always been this way, but I really want to make every chance I can to express what I think people are forces of good in the world.
Yeah.
And I just think that we've seen that through and through with Dayton. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. I did not know that part of it. I know exactly kind of that decision. The Cardinals urged us not to go. In fact, told us that they would strongly say we should not go to cover it. I said that's not an option. And then the Tavares family said that they would like us there. And that's what tipped the scales for us, was how do we figure this out and make this happen when the team has told us not to go. But the family has asked us to be there, and the decision was very easy. And it was one of the more, it was a colossal tragedy, just like with Ventura. And you saw it in the neighborhood, and you saw it in the faces of the young kids there, what it meant to them, saw the anguish in the parents, and people that loved Oscar. And, you know, when the burial happened, the people from St. Louis were Chris and me and Carlos Martinez, and Oscar's agent from Miami had come with his group. And that was the people that were there. And it, you know, and then obviously what happened, I think the community helped us so much that night. I mean, we wrote at it because we didn't have our computers or anything because they were stolen. We wrote at the house of a local gentleman who moved his son's sixth birthday party out to the front lawn so that we could rearrange the tables that they had birthday cake on, so that we could write on the computers and stuff. And, you know, Jesse Sanchez was there from MLB.com, and he was such a great help and such a champion in trying to help us work through it. The mayor of, you know, Oscar Tavares' hometown made sure that we had ways to drive around, took the battered car back to the airport for us. It was a community that recognized what had happened, and that we had come at the request of the family. And I think it was an experience unlike any other. And I wish that I never had to go there because of the tragedy that meant we had to go there. But I'm proud of the work that we did there. And I'm just as proud of the presence that we were there, regardless of what. I mean, we lost stuff. We lost stuff. Who cares about stuff?
Right. Well, but listen.
But we wrote a story that outlasted the stuff, I hope.
I know you did. And I think this, you know, we come to different points where you wonder what the significance of what you're trying to do is. And like you, I dearly wish that we weren't in position to have to go try to tell that story, but also felt like it was one of the most important things I ever did, to be there. And, you're making me think of this right now. You're standing in a room, not much bigger than this room in my office with 6'8", Royals players, you know, Gerard Dyson and Mike Moustakas and Sal Perez. Amazing. And Greg Holland, Eric Hosmer, and watching Dayton hold the hands of the Ventura family and tell them what an honor it is to mourn with them. And that's what I think of, right? I think that, you know, that aspect of it, really lending comfort to the family, really lending comfort to Kansas City. And anyway, I'm going on and on again, but it's something I think about quite often, and I think about Giordano quite often, and how Giordano felt about Oscar, and all these things, and this is what we do this for, I guess, you know,
to
tell these stories in the best ways we can at the hardest times at times.
You just described, Vahe, how baseball can bring people together, how it can help heal, how it can bridge a city in the middle of America with an island, you know, in the middle of the Caribbean, and communities on both places, just by being a shared language of a sport, a shared love of a sport. In that vein, and acknowledging that, as you said earlier, that you and I can both be a little romantic with stuff, what role do you envision baseball playing in what I guess we're calling the reopening of America, but the revitalization of communities, which both have to happen? And should baseball play a leading part in that?
Well, one of the things I've thought about sports in general is what it can do in the months to come, and should and can, I guess, are maybe different things. But, you know, I think we have to realize that we're talking about twin forces here in the reopening now, right? It's coming mm-hmm. back from the coronavirus, but it's also coming back from this just excruciating situation with racial injustice in our country and the strife that has come out of that, and you know, America crying, America on fire. So maybe it's inappropriate to see those as, you know, combined, for they're two different, very different things, but they're part of what we're going to be coming out of. I don't know that I can get my arms around what that could and should look like to fulfill the best angels of our nature, whatever the right way that would be. But I think our leaders in sports would do well to be cognizant of their greater calling here than just to get games going. I mean, I know there's going to be a temptation like, oh, we need diversion. Oh, once you just get games going, that's great. Well, the context of the times has been totally reframed by what we're experiencing right now. We have no reason to even necessarily be able to dig in and understand that we're going to be able to start playing. I mean, things might start happening, but things might shut down again. There's so many factors at play. So I guess I just hope that that sports, that baseball sees that as part of its purpose, understands that as part of its purpose, and is thoughtful about how it acts. I'd have to think harder and longer, and probably still would fail, about what specifically that would look like. But I just think that they're all these organizations will be getting off on the wrong foot if they're not thinking it through philosophically about their obligation to society, what they can be, right? Maybe I shouldn't say obligation, but what they can be.
It's interesting you bring that. I'm always fascinated by how Kansas City and St. Louis are connected by more than I-70. And, you know, this year there's a sports example of that, where in St. Louis, you know, the St. Louis Blues are defending the first Stanley Cup in franchise history. And then over yonder in Kansas City, you have the Chiefs, who are defending the Super Bowl championship. And yet in both cities, you also have this baseball team that helps identify the communities. In St. Louis, you know, the Blues winning the Stanley Cup certainly grabbed attention. But the Cardinals remain the, you know, sort of the historic Goliath of sports in this town. And one of its, you know, liaisons to the globe. I mean, I would imagine that you go to Italy, you're going to see Cardinals caps. You know, you're going to hear about the Arch and Anheuser-Busch and the Cardinals, or baseball, when you talk about St. Louis. Kansas City, the Chiefs are king, right? I mean, that there's no question about that. So where do the Royals kind of fit into the sports landscape, and have they lost any ground by not playing, or how does that work, Vi?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic right now, because if you think about it, you have quite this, you've never had more of an extreme on this point, which is the Chiefs just won the Super Bowl and they're the last champion in sports, and the Royals aren't playing, and the Royals are coming off back-to-back 100 loss seasons. But I think this, the Royals, I guess you'd have to say the Chiefs are king. I agree with that. But the Royals are really something this community is proud of, despite their ups and downs, despite their really rough last 35, 40 years, other than a 2 or 3 year peak, especially 2 year peak.
Right.
They're really, I don't know if enmeshed is the right word, especially since I think I used that word earlier, but they're really connected with the community here in such a way that the ballpark experience is not what it is in St. Louis, right? It's just a sheer numbers game in some ways, but it is a great experience. I mean, it is a
beautiful ballpark experience.
It's always customer oriented, whether it's the people we speak to in the parking lots, the people that are welcoming us in the gates, whether it's the media relations people, whether it's Dayton Moore, whether it's players, and that emanates around the city. And I will say also this, that in 2014 and 2015, that level of thrill was singular. I mean, obviously the Chiefs finally winning the Super Bowl after 50 years was its own amazing, just ball of emotion for the city. I don't exactly know how to compare those two, but I would say they were pretty close. And part of it was that I'm sure the Royals, had not even been to a postseason since 85 when they got to game 7 of the World Series in 14. The nature of the comebacks, the wild card game against the A's,
the
2015, there was a daily level of thrill to that was, kind of breathtaking. And it's one of those things that does distinguish baseball from football a little bit, that, the buildup to the drama is, virtually every day during October, as opposed to, I got to wait 2 weeks now, or I got to wait a week. There's something a little different in the mechanism. It's advantage baseball on that, I think, in terms of keeping that going. The joy at the parade in 2015, I think, was certainly comparable, if not, it's hard to say how it is because it's a different crowd. It's a different time of year. It's way colder when the Chiefs won, all those things. But I also think a lid came off in 2015 because Kansas City, other than 2013 MLS, which was great, but not exactly the same as the NFL or MLB. It was at the end of a sense of long suffering in 2015. And still you had that, queasy feeling about when will the Chiefs ever break out. But once they got Patrick Mahomes, you really did kind of know, even when they lost to the Patriots that way the year before, you kind of thought it was the start of something, not just another same old, playoff hideous ending.
When we'll get to the new manager in a moment, because a new manager is part of what Kansas City had planned for 2020, but what kind of team did the Royals want to have in 2020? What if the Cardinals and Royals do end up, if baseball does get itself together and get a season together and the Royals and Cardinals end up in the same division, what kind of team would the Cardinals be looking at?
Well, it's a very interesting team with some really fascinating X factors. So you got Alex Gordon kind of coming back into form, maybe not what he was in his prime, but a real resurgence last season. You got young guys like Hunter Dozier and Bubba Starling who had flashes. Well, Bubba had a flash, but Hunter Dozier really became a factor last year. And you got mainstays like Whit Merrifield, who's had a couple years now of leading the league in hitting, and Sal Perez back, and Mondesi. Right. You think his health is going to be there? So long and short, I'm kind of just scatter shooting, but I think their lineup's pretty loaded with potential. I think their lineup could be pretty good. We don't quite understand their pitching yet. And that's what a lot of teams say, but I think I think they'll score runs, and I don't think, you know, you could say they're ready to really compete in a standard sense, but I don't really think I even understand how this format's going to play out. So, look, you could, in fact, I pulled this article out a couple of weeks ago. I guess I still pull out articles instead of just pasting them, but you know, what baseball is going to, who's going to have the advantage in a shortened season, right? I mean, how that's going to play out. And now we've seen enough over here. We've seen a lot of Aprils and Mays where a 5-23 start ends the season. So if that's what happens, then of course, you know, that's pretty much literally is the season. But you know, who's to say that you can't get off to a hot start and catch lightning in a bottle in this situation. And so it's the teams that are most equipped to come out of the gates that are really going to be interesting to follow along here. And I don't know what's going to dictate that, right? To some degree, it's finding that I don't know what the right term is, the sort of the resting that's not the right term, but being able to be as close as possible to engaging that gear that you're ready to go.
Right.
Without having peaked, without having gotten lazy, all that. And who knows who is cracking that code, right? I mean, that is really hard to see.
There's an analogy with a manual transmission car that probably is so outdated where you could say like which team is ready to pop the clutch faster when the light goes green. The one that's not like that. In neutral, the one that's not in park, the one that is already in gear and just needs to let the clutch go.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that does a podcast audience get that? Is that, am I dating myself?
Well, as the joke goes, you're the only one who would, but I'm, hey, by the way, you made me realize though, I typically, as usual, buried the lead. You know, the other thing about the Royals, it's interesting for, you know, Cardinals fans thinking about them really is Jorge Soler, who had 48 home runs last year. I mean, shattered the Royals record, which was a modest record held by Mike Moustakas. Royals haven't had that player. And, you know, it's clear that he prospers from being DH only. So, you know, there's questions about how that plays out naturally now too, but, you know, the Royals have been largely a small ball team when they've been successful, with some pop, but
yeah.
So anyway, it's an intriguing lineup, but subject to the, X factors of how the season's going to be administered.
Is one of those X factors the new manager, Mike Matheny, Cardinals manager for 7 years, beloved catcher for the Cardinals, now moving over to the other side of the state to get a second chance at managing? Is he one of those factors, or is he more of a known quantity?
Well, that's a great question, and it really is a great question. You know, I felt like in spring training and what we've seen of Mike, both before and after, I felt like he was a known factor, even though we know he actually basically is an X factor because we haven't seen him back at work since he lost his job in St. Louis.
Right.
So, and someone whose skill set was so vast and yet had gaps in his game from what we saw in St. Louis, who by every indication here has worked at all times to make himself more prepared for the next job, further educate himself. And you know this, very smart in the game. I can only say that I've been very impressed by him, impressed by his energy, impressed by his engagement with players, particularly younger players. You know, he made it a point after getting the job to travel around the country to see a lot of players.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. He was in Miami. I'm not sure if he saw everybody he knew was coming back, but certainly in double digits, I would say. And that has extended to what's going on in what was going on in spring training. It's my understanding it's extending to what's going on in Zoom calls. Dayton said he's been trying to get Mike to complain and he can't get him to complain. I think there's something a little bit, you know, contagious about that, which is probably not a word you use in these times, but I think you know my meaning.
Yeah.
So all that, we still don't know what the effect of that will be, but I do feel like he's brought a new energy when the Royals needed new energy. I do feel like he has prospered from the last couple years of reflection. And I'm not exactly privy to how it unraveled in St. Louis. I mean, I certainly have a strong sense of it from reading your great work and understanding what's gone on there. But when you're not on the scene, you don't exactly feel it.
No. Yeah.
So I'm pretty bullish on him as it stands now, as someone who will find a way to, has been finding a way to keep these guys motivated and interested and invested. But we won't know until we see what's happening. Right. That's the oddity of the moment.
You wrote a very detailed and deep look at Mike during spring training, and one of the best stories I read from the Royals, you know, camp there in Arizona. How much time was that following him, observing him, and how much time was that talking with him? And then the follow up to that is, how open was he about mistakes made and improvements he had to acknowledge?
Well, let me go back a little bit. When he first got the job, he had a fine press conference. I mean, I think he won the press conference, but after the press conference, I think he spent about 45 minutes or an hour with 8 or 10 of us. And he was amazing. And spoke very specifically to a variety of situations. I can't quite recall the specifics of what we asked him about then, but I do remember feeling like he's being very candid. He's owning that. He's talking about things that he needed to understand better. You know, he talked about getting media coaching. He talked about different ways he was going about his own self-awareness, self-improvement. And look, you know, we on all fronts, we know that it is one thing to talk about things, another thing to do it. But there was something about what he was talking about that was doing it, you know, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
So at spring training, I was there for maybe 5 days. And as you know, way better than I do, you get a certain amount of sessions with groups. But I set out to get, a longer period of time with him. And we broke it down into a couple different phases just because he was, building the foundation, right? I mean, he was frantic, but frantic's the wrong word because it implies being reckless, but he was just hair on fire.
Frenetic.
Everywhere, right? Yeah, frenetic. And he was, that was easy to observe, by the way, and good to just observe. I mean, I could go out and just watch him be out in the field and talk to people about what they were seeing. We had our longest times together over at, away from the Royals complex, over at another stadium. And the thing that stuck out to me was completely undivided attention. Really listening to the questions, really spending time thinking about answering them. He had to, after I'm making this time up, but let's say it was 25 minutes, he had to literally run out to batting practice, but said, hey, let's just come back in here in hour and a half and let's keep going, and would have kept going more. So he was very generous with his time. He's been generous with his time since then. Made it clear that you can call anytime. I spent a lot of time with him on the phone. I want to say, I don't know, let's say it was late March. And we talked about what he's doing with this time and how it compares to how he learned from, how he's benefited now from going through all the concussion issues. How it provided him with mechanisms for this in a way, like whether it's, you know, playing chess or you know, refining a language or music. We talked a lot about him playing the guitar. Anyway, it was all really interesting, and it might be of interest to your readers if they didn't see it. I can't remember what the Google keywords would be, but Mike Matheny and guitar and my name might bring it up. It might be stuff you guys have written about plenty of times. Probably is, but was new to our audience.
It's interesting, Vahe. Did he describe those as coping mechanisms?
I don't.
Is that the wrong phrase?
Use that term particularly? Did I say that? I'm worried that I might have said that.
No. I'm asking that because I found it fascinating. Like, you know, yeah. I mean, what's the phrase? You know, you got to find your center. You know, and how you deal with stress is, you know, it's part coping, it's part, you know, response to time away from your job. Like, how do you improve on that? I mean, like, I'll give a personal example. Like this time where I'm not traveling all that much, I've been able to, you know, and been forthright with trying to, you know, spark some of that creativity that, you know, that I like did it as a kid, for lack of a better example. You know me, you met me when I was a cartoonist at the Maneater trying to figure out how to be a writer. I've drawn more in the past few months than I did in the past. I've been able to read a lot and read in different things. And, you know, and part of it is like, hey, I'm looking for ways to, and I've had to learn new skills for the newspaper. Made a small film for my son's birthday. So I have learned new skills, but I realized that maybe at the core, it's about trying to find that center, that creativity that is a coping mechanism. So that's why I asked.
Well, you're certainly hitting at the crux of what he's thinking about, and we all would benefit from thinking about it right now. And it's something that my wife Cindy and I talk about now too. I just found the column that we use these terms around the house, and I just seem to insert them in the column. Are we just passing time to get to the other side, or spending it like it's precious? And this is part of really what we got talking about with him. And you know, so obviously they're spending a lot of time together as a family. Three of the five children are living on site with him. At least they were at this point. But they're, you know, one of his sons is a really good guitar player, and they're passing the guitar back and forth, watching movies together, et cetera, which, you know, we know many families are doing this. But he was just talking about, you know, learning to slow down. And he did feel there was a real parallel with the time of recovering from the concussions. So guitar was part of his way. I'm trying to see if there's any of those words, you know, specific to coping, but it seems less about that than about embracing the moment. And maybe that's the same thing, right? Maybe that's
might be semantics.
A way of coping. So as he puts it, you know, you can either do something productive or just end up wasting time. And next thing you know, you look up and it's later than you want it to be. So I like that. I felt actually very inspired by how he looked at it. It really was something I felt like, yeah, that makes sense. I should employ this thinking.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, it's not what the Royals had in mind when they hired Matheny. You know, they thought he'd be in uniform at this time in the dugout and being part of, you know, nurturing and seasoning and sharpening and honing players by way of games. But I wonder if this, and this is what I wanted to ask you, if maybe this fits into his skill set even better, because he's not managing games now, but he is still managing people. So if he can inspire through an interview, then maybe he's the guy that can also pilot a team or an organization through a period like this.
Well, listen, I think that makes that really resonates. And I think like Dayton, you know, Mike wants to, I think, influence beyond just the field if he can. And you know, that's a whole nother topic maybe for another time. But I think the point is that he's being felt throughout the organization. And I think he sees that as what he ought to be able to do, that he ought to be trying to have that kind of impact. And I think he's treated it right. I think he's not been overbearing in some of the ways people have seen him be in the past, and yet able to be vibrant even through Zoom calls. And so I think that's astute. I think he's, this isn't how he would have set it up. Nobody would set it up this way, but I think he's also recognized that, he's supposed to be nimble. He's supposed to adjust to the times, adjust to situations. And this is another one of them.
It's fascinating. There's the motto for FC Barcelona, right? Just because we've gone now full circle talking, starting out about Dayton Moore and what the Kansas City Royals did with their minor leaguers, but also what he had to say about the reasoning before it. Now back to Mike and what you're talking about being more than just somebody who pulls levers and pushes buttons and writes out a lineup, but somebody who, you know, shapes better natures. There's the slogan for FC Barcelona, and I'm probably going to butcher it's Més que un club, right? And it's more than a club. And that's why they had like on their uniforms, their kits for so many years. And when I had the amazing opportunity to go to a game at Camp Nou in Barcelona, I got a pin, and it was the same logo that they had on their kits at the time, which was this, the M E with the accent S for more. Right. And their notion is that you are more than a professional team. You are part of the community. And therefore you need to give to the community and represent the community. You know, it was for a long time, you know, like say UNICEF was on their kits, right? You know, they wanted to be an organization beyond just slapping the latest tech startup or big car company on their kits. So they wanted to be more than a club. And I think there's an element there, right? Like if you're part of a small market in baseball, you have historic roots in that city. You have the summer to yourself in that city for the most part. You benefit by being more than a club. You know, be more than a baseball team. And you know, it seems like the Royals are taking that to heart, and maybe always have, because they have leaders who do that. But it's also something that worries me that by baseball reducing the size of the minor leagues, they're saying, no, you know what, baseball in this neighborhood or this community or in this town, then we're not going to be more than a club. We're just going to be a business, and we're going to be a big box business, and we're moving on. And there's something to be said about baseball's opportunity to be more than a club.
There is, and you're making me think of this sort of literal grassroots point that George Thoma, the fabled groundskeeper, one of his expressions, I don't recall, he might have taken it from George Brett, he might have learned it when he grew up back home in Wilkes-Barre, PA, but he learned the practice of always adding the term "and then some" to whatever he took on, and then some. And you know, that has a nice application to this, I think. You know, we just want to be that, or you want to be and then some.
Wow. Well, Vahe, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. I've said it publicly many times, and I can't say it enough, how much you've meant to my career as a mentor and as a friend. And, you know, you've given me a lot of advice and a lot of encouragement, and you've set forth a tremendous role model for me to follow. And then some, to borrow the phrase. So thank you very much for having this conversation with me. Much appreciated. I hope you're healthy and doing well, and best to your wife.
Well, you stole my term. I wanted to say I've gotten it back and then some from you and your listeners. I hope will know that my office is dotted with wonderful appreciation points from you, whether it's postcards or the you know what I'm going to talk about, the illustration artistry of congratulating me for a Missouri Sports Writer of the Year award, et cetera. But you've been a wonderful force in my life, and I feel like we're lucky to be friends.
I look forward to when we're at a ballpark together and social distancing doesn't keep us apart. I came upon like one of my last photos of us together. It was at Ben Fredrickson's wedding, and what a treat that was to sneak away to meet at the midpoint of the state, right in the middle of a season, and share a hug. So I look forward to sharing a ballpark with you at some point and seeing you in person. Bye.
Same here, Derek.
Of course, thanks to Kansas City Star sports columnist and longtime friend Vahe Gregorian for joining me here for that conversation. You can find the best podcast in baseball and, of course, all of our Constant Cardinals coverage at stltoday.com. There are weekly Cardinals chats, there are Constant columns, and there are stories already there on the website from this past week that explored the future lineup of the Cardinals based on the roster they have now in the minor leagues, as well as a look, an analytical look, and where things stand on the negotiations between owners and players for a return to play this summer. It seems acrimonious. There's a lot of rhetoric flying around, but that's part of the job of negotiations, to circle and circle and circle various points until they arrive at a midpoint, which it's just going to take time. You can also find a story of the Cardinals' return to Busch Stadium. Four Cardinals went to Busch Stadium this past Wednesday. Adam Wainwright, Gung Young Kim through live BP to Colton Wong and Paul DeYoung. It was the first baseball activities on the field at Busch Stadium for the 2020 season. A small step towards normalcy, but still a step towards normalcy. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. That includes iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes. You can subscribe to the podcast. It's subscriptions that make the sponsorships possible, and it's sponsorships that make this weekly podcast possible, which, because of the sponsor, we've been able to do even throughout the stoppage of games, a weekly podcast here, give or take a furlough. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast there. I've learned a lot from the reviews, the direction you want the podcast to go, because, like baseball, this podcast is only as good as the community that it has gathered. Its strength draws from its listeners and subscribers, so thank you very much for that. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closets by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closets by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. For BPIB and STLtoday.com, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Look forward to talking to you soon. Stay healthy out there.